Good morning, everybody, and from me as well, welcome to Buddha Day. I'm Satya Para, and I thought this morning we could do something that I'm quite fond of doing, which involves the imagination. It's kind of taking the stories, taking whatever we know about the Buddha, whatever we've been told, whatever we've read. About the Buddha, taking it through a process of our own imagination. And I always think a bit of that, like, I don't know if any of you are into yeast cultures, but I am. And it's like, it's a process of fermenting, it's something that is growing, it's something that is alive. So rather than it just being a story that we've heard, it's going to become something that we actually connect to. And for those who know me, I'm quite interested in alchemy. I think alchemy is a really useful image, to look at things, to make things meaningful. And I'm really grateful to have the chance to give this talk because it's something I've been like, something that has been brewing within my own imagination for quite a number of years. And it's this idea of the Buddha as the alchemist, so the alchemical Buddha. And it's something that is very alive for me. And only this morning, when we were doing the Shakyamuni visualization, it's just like all these elements that kind of just constantly come up. And there's something very archetypal. So we're entering here into a world of myths, which is, which is beyond, I suppose, beyond our conceptual mind. So we're kind of involving the imagination to connect with the Buddha. So that's what we're going to do this morning. I will give you images. I will give you my own interpretation. But then hopefully in the second half after the tea break, you'll kind of have the chance to make your own connections. Let the images speak to yourself, because there's no, it's not because I'm sitting here telling things that they're right. They're just products of my own imagination. So I think it's something important to engage with a myth of around the Buddha's enlightenment. I think in the West we kind of often, we come to Buddhism in a kind of, well, I think the worst one is the secular mindfulness way, we're kind of stripped of all mythic context. But we kind of have a highly critical mind here in the West, and it's a danger that we kind of look at Buddhism as a set of practices, a set of rules, to gain enlightenment, whatever enlightenment might be. I think, on the other hand, it's also quite perhaps less dangerous for most of us. But, it can be also a tendency of taking the stories literally. So if we kind of think of the Buddha, the Buddha leaving the palace in the middle of the night and the horse, the hooves of the horse, leaflet of flowers, then we kind of take that as literally has happened. So that's kind of the other danger. So we're kind of trying to stay in the middle here, and we're trying to just let the images speak to us. Today we're celebrating the Buddha's enlightenment, and traditionally it's celebrated on the full moon of May. But I think because of practical reasons, that didn't happen. So we're a few weeks early, but just pretend it's full moon. And it's interesting, this bit about the moon, that's already one thing. So traditionally, all the festivals, the Buddhist festivals, are all happening on a full moon day. And it's kind of believed that whatever we do on a full moon, like the merits we gain from it are kind of, I don't know how many times multiplied, probably depending with which version you read. But, it's something of like, whatever we do on a full moon day increases in meaning, increases in importance. It's said like in the mythological life of the Buddha was born on a full moon, he gained enlightenment on a full moon, he went forth on a full moon, and he died on a full moon. Probably that was like more for practical reasons, because they followed the moon calendar in those days. But I think it's also for me, like the moon also represents that kind of more reflective aspect of our experience, the more the feminine aspect of our experience. So it's very interesting that that kind of, that aspect is kind of, it's very strong present in the Buddha's life. So it's not the Buddha. I think later on in texts, he becomes a bit of a conqueror. You know, he becomes this kind of, he defeats evil. But actually, if you kind of look at the mythology of the early, the events in the Buddhist life, is actually more a receptive quality. So that receptive quality is something we're really going to need this morning, Well, we need it and throughout the whole of our practice, something we kind of, the openness of heart is something that is really important for us as practitioners. So just remembering this full moon and the moon kind of comes in all sorts of different forms, I suppose. We have the white cloth representing the moon. Often in tankas in Tibetan tankas, we've got a moon and a sun, so the moon is there. Bodhisattvas are sitting on a moon mat, so it's like the moon comes through, reminding us again and again of the importance of this aspect. So the other thing that is really important to remember is that the Buddha lived 2,500 years ago. And he lived, from the scriptures we can tell that he lived in a very animated world. He lived in a world where, where snakes became princes and, animals could speak and horses could fly and things like that. So that would have been like quite normal because he lived in quite what we would now say like a primitive culture, and primitive cultures have this rich kind of animated world. They saw the importance of the world and they kind of, gave it personality, I suppose. Another way of looking at it is an enchanted world, and I really like the word enchanted. Because it kind of brings the magical quality of the world around us alive. So he lived in this enchanted world. And I think it's something, again, here in the West that we kind of lost a fair bit, especially since the Age of Enlightenment. Funnily enough, it's also called Enlightenment, isn't it? So it's like here in the West, there's been this tradition, of trying to explain the natural world. And that might have had, many good consequences. There's also something, what I find has been like, something has been lost, something has been reduced. The natural world has become a world that's been explained in laws and regularities, things that are quite random. For example, the movement of the planets mathematicians are trying to explain them in like quite simple formulations, and it's like, so everything kind of has been formulated, has been, there's laws invented in a way. I read this bit about Darwin and it really struck me, and it seems that Darwin like was really overwhelmed by the beauty of the natural world, and he was so overwhelmed that he encountered this huge fear. And through this fear, he formulated all these laws, which actually represent quite a cruel, blood-shedding natural world. Whilst if you look at it in a totally different way, it's like it doesn't have to be like that. But we take these laws, the survival of the fittest. It's like we take this as a law these days. We take it literally. Whilst it can be just, some kind of random thing. I mean, not everything needs to be explained. So it's that kind of reducing our experience, reducing the world we're living in into something simplistic, something utilitarian. That's the other aspect of it. It becomes something that we can use, that is useful, that we can explain, that we can predict, rather than, something that we just experience, I suppose. And this, the thread of this all is kind of this reduction of the imaginal, the reduction of what I maybe like the magical or something. Yeah. So it's led to a very materialistic and utilitarian view of the world that we have. And I think as practitioners, we have a great opportunity to open up to something more imaginative, to make us feel more connected to the world rather than separated from it. So this kind of comes down to like this enchanted world that the Buddha lived in was actually a world that had intrinsic value. It didn't have to be explained. It didn't have to follow certain rules. And if we kind of start to involve our imagination, we start to involve our heart in our experience. And I think that's another something that I read quite a few years ago, but I find extremely inspiring, is the heart as the organ of imagination. It's through the heart that we take in the world. Which kind of, as a practitioner, really, you know, is the compassionate element of the Buddha's teaching. You know, it's through compassion that we actually experience the world around us. And it's interesting, so traditionally the heart, so this goes back to the ancient Greeks, so traditionally the heart has always been that organ of connecting with the world. And only now, recently, like, are scientists actually catching up and recognizing that it's the heart sending impulses to the brain that make us respond to the world, basically. So the Buddha lived in this natural world, and from what we know about what we think is the historical Buddha, he probably wasn't, he wasn't a scholar, that's for sure. He most likely wasn't able to read or write or anything. So it wasn't like he sat down and came up with a whole set of theories, what we then called Buddhism later. So the Buddha, the enlightened enlightenment experience is very much an experience. So the Buddha's wisdom is experiential. So it's not a set of rules. It's not a set of formulations. And I think what is really interesting about the Buddha, and I really like this in the Rupa, is the Buddha was someone who is fully opened to the world. So if we think about what enlightenment might mean, it's that kind of openness, that receptiveness towards the world. And I think it's really beautiful because his robes, you know, he has like his heart is not covered, his heart is left bare. And he has these huge ears, you know, to take in the world constantly. So he was alive to the world, and he was, he responded to the world. He paid attention to the world. So I think that's just for me. This is a really big clue of what I'm supposed to be doing if I call myself a Buddhist or if I want to practice the Dharma. Is that sense of being alive, being paying attention to the world, basically. So I suppose rather than just limiting ourselves to the formulations or however helpful they might be, you know, it's something more of, you know, letting the world pour into our experience. So coming back to the alchemy then. Alchemy in itself is a myth. I mean, there's a lot of obscurity around how it's came about and, you know, whether it survived or not or all the rest of it. So it's already, I kind of like these things that you're not quite sure of whether they were real or not. It's said that certain old texts of alchemy were preserved. When Constantinople fell into the hands of the Ottomans, they were like rescued by local mystics and brought to Florence. And it seems to kind of have had its heyday in the Renaissance, and then kind of slightly tailed off again until I think, well, what we kind of know most about alchemy comes through Carl Jung, who kind of towards the end of his life he saw alchemy as like the main metaphor, I suppose, of the human mind. Yeah, so alchemical texts aren't like easy to read or easy to understand, or but you'll find a certain richness in it, and I think it's that kind of the richness that I feel really drawn to. So yeah, and I think the other thing about alchemy is there's always the I suppose the obscurity, whether you're working on something out there or whether you're working on your own mind. So there's the alchemist, it's like he kind of takes the raw material, the raw metals, and transforms them into gold. That's like the, you know, the kind of basic myth around it. But whilst he's doing that, he's actually working on his own mind, you know, so there's always the kind of the mirroring, the reflectiveness between the material he's working on and his own mental state. And I think that's why I find it, as you know, as a meditator, so inspiring to kind of work with that, because it kind of, you know, constantly have that kind of creative tension. And I think the other thing about alchemy, it's not so much, although we kind of think it's all about the gold at the end, like we set off and we kind of, you know, when we start meditating, we think it's all about getting enlightened, getting insight, getting this or getting that. It's like, it's actually not that. It's about the process. It's a constant movement. It's the constant work we're doing, where actually, you know, the wisdom will come from. And then there's, I suppose there's a third dimension. It's like through doing that, through working on, you know, the raw materials, there's a transformation, the transformation of the world as well. So it's kind of this three-way, you know, this three, I don't know what it is, these three dynamics that you can look at. So looking at all of that, I can't help but thinking that the Buddha was actually an alchemist. And then this morning in the meditation, it's like I suddenly was really drawn to the Buddha's begging bowl. And it's like, this is it. This is his alchemical cauldron. You know, this is where all the work happens, in that black bowl, basically. So the again, it's like depending on which alchemical texts you read, there's different phases in it, but there's kind of four stages that are kind of quite common in most texts. So I'll just limit myself to those four. And the first one is the what is called the blackening. It's called the nigredo. So the nigredo is like it's a stage of descent. It's a stage of confusion, depression. It's a stage of things falling apart, basically. And I think that's another interesting point about alchemy. Things need to fall apart. They need to be separated before they can be joined up again. So the alchemist starts in this state of chaos. We haven't been doing very well in our chaos here in the room, though, so that says already something. So maybe after the talk, we need to create a bit more chaos. So it's like he starts with this kind of, you know, an anxious state, a depressed state, chaos in his mind. The work he's doing in this state is very slow, it's repetitive, it's, you know, it's like, I think we kind of get a picture of the kind of, you know, you're kind of trying to do something, but you feel like you're not going anywhere. And it's quite a natural, I suppose it's a natural stage, it's a stage of the mind being melancholic, and it's really important to allow that stage, you know, to take its time. And I think our current culture, and again, is not very supportive of depression and things like that. So anyway, so there's that melancholy, that kind of darkness rising up. And if we look at the Buddha's story, so there's this young prince living in this amazing palace with all the luxurious things you can ever imagine. And he experienced this sense of dissatisfaction. He experienced a sense of something isn't right in his life. And his response to that is like he wants to be taken out into the world. So he asks his charioteer to kind of take him out, basically. And in the world, in the city, he sees these things. He sees old age, sickness, and death as for the first time, we are told. So he sees these things, and he starts reflecting upon them. When he's back in the palace, he starts reflecting, and he starts thinking, it's like, you know, all of this will disappear, all the people I love will die. You know, he realizes his own mortality, and he kind of starts losing interest in the life in the palace. So if we kind of look at this, like, if he would have been living, you know, in our current age, he would probably have been diagnosed with depression and given a pill. So luckily, he didn't, you know, he didn't live in this age. So he kind of had an alternative, and that alternative was this fourth sight, seeing this sage, seeing this kind of different way of living a life. So he saw the holy man, and he started considering whether this would be something, you know, that might be more meaningful. And so one night he kind of hopped on his horse and he rode off into the darkness, into the night. He left everything behind, basically. And at the edge of the forest, he swaps clothes with his servant, so he disguises himself. And he goes forth in the darkness of the forest. So if you think about that, this young prince, never been out of the palace, by himself in a dark forest, you know, I think he must have been pretty scared, to be honest. He didn't have a clue where to go from there. He didn't have any friends. He didn't know what to do, basically. All he kind of had was this sense of what I had wasn't doing it for me, and so I'm trying something different. So luckily for him, you know, in this forest, there's other people, you know, wandering around, practicing things. So he starts trying things out. You know, he goes through this phase of trying one practice after another. And it's like every time he goes so far and he ends up in this kind of dead-end stream, he ends up where he kind of, he feels it's not working. It's not going to, you know, it's not going to take him where he wants to be. He gets this sense of stuckness. You know, he kind of, every time he feels, you know, this is not going to be it. Until the moment where he bathes himself and he practically dies in the river. You know, he collapses. He nearly drowns. Luckily, he didn't for us. So it's that kind of real strong descent. It's him kind of falling apart nearly to, you know, the point of death. It's everything is kind of, you know, dark, dead. And he, you know, he just kind of has one failure after another and after another. And it's at a point where he kind of collapses in the river. He thinks, well, I better eat something or I actually die without having found any meaning. So is that kind of, I suppose that's like the moment, which is also a very strong alchemical symbol image, which is the black sun. So it's like, in this all this blackness, there is a sun, there is some light, there is like, there is kind of, I suppose, a wisdom coming through in that, you know, he kind of hits rock bottom. And then there's something that he kind of thinks, okay, I need to do something different. So there's a little bit of insight coming through when he realizes he needs to eat. And I think this whole phase is like just this big symbol of this exhaustion, you know, exhausting all the willfulness, all the, you know, where he kind of does things to kind of trying to reach something. And again, it's something we kind of all come across in our own practice, in our own life, is that kind of willfulness. If we need to do this, we need to do that. And in the end, it's like he exhausts all of that in quite an extreme way. So then the second stage in the alchemical process is called the whitening, the albedo. So the whitening is quite a delicate phase in a way. It's like there's a bit more energy. It's not as dark. It's not as kind of tiring, I suppose, as the blackening. But it's quite delicate because there's the darkness is lifting. There's a cooling down. There's an intense suffering is kind of leaving a bit. And there's a bit more energy. And it's said that like a lot of people commit suicide at that point. So a it's not very cheerful. It's that kind of energy of, you know, the energy comes out, so it's a phase where we need to be very careful, very sensitive, I suppose, towards ourselves. And one of the symbols of this is the moon. So it's the kind of the whiteness, the whitening of the moon. The moon brings that kind of indirect light in a way. It brings indirect light upon our experience, and it gives us the ability to reflect. So I think another symbol of this phase is silvering. So silver as the metal of, you know, like mirrors, you know, the metal that reflects. So there's the ability to reflect upon our experience. So is that kind of the dark material is all brought out into the soft light of the moon. So it's kind of some quite different from the harsh light of the sun. It's a softness. It's still it's obscure. It's kind of softening. The edges are a bit blurred. So it's that kind of this sense. And it's a very delicate stage in that it's a stage of listening. It's that kind of real receptivity of the moon coming through. It's sensing where we're at, listening to our experience. Attending, I suppose, is another way of looking at it. So the whitening is also kind of allowing the consciousness to kind of be more open, be open in a different way. It's kind of more in a poetic way. And I think that's where creativity comes from. So we kind of, you know, we're a bit more open, a bit more fluid. We're less fixed in who we think we are, so we can be something different. And it's allowing things to be different from the kind of rational way of, the rational interpreting kind of mind. So in the Buddha's story, So the Buddha's been completely exhausted, and then he takes this rice and milk. So these are two white substances, which I find interesting, from a shepherd's girl. So he's taking it from a woman. So we have that femininity coming through as well. And he goes and sits beneath a tree and rests. And what then happens is quite... I find it really inspiring because it's the moment, it's the thing on which the whole of this tradition is based upon. And all it's based upon is about on a childhood memory of a young prince, a young Indian prince. So this young prince is sitting completely exhausted underneath this tree. And he has this memory as a child when he sits watching his father and, you know, the workmen ploughing the land. On a sunny afternoon, he's sitting under a rose apple tree. And he just watches them, and he starts to feel very peaceful and very much part of, you know, the scenery, what he sees around him, you know, what he experiences. He feels part of the world. And I think it's really interesting because there's that kind of... So it comes from a childhood memory. There's an innocence kind of coming through here. And I think, again, it's like, well, hopefully most of us had a fairly reasonable, happy childhood, or at least with some happy memories. And hopefully there's something in there that you can... recognizes that moment, you know, as a child when you're playing, where you just feel part of what you're doing, you feel part of this world. So that's the kind of the key thing that kind of gives the Buddha, this young prince, or the Buddha to be, a clue of what he needs to do, which is basically sitting and, you know, getting absorbed in his experience. So then the third phase in the alchemical process is called yellowing. And these different phases, so it's said that alchemy comes from a process of like craftsmanship. And it's said every time a material changes color, the essence changes. So in the yellowing, the essence of the experience starts to change again. And I think it's something... You know, if you think of fruit, when fruit kind of ripens, it's, you know, it kind of changes, the substance changes. It's like a brown banana is quite different in substance from a green one. So it's that kind of, you know, the change of the essence. So this yellowing is representing a change. And it's also, I think it's quite often quite complex, because he's also having this sense of like this, the world starts creeping in. So it's like the Buddha, he's gone through this blackening, which is all about his willfulness. You know, then there was the whitening, which is a bit more reflective, but still very, very much introverted. And then he realizes through this memory that there's something about, you know, letting the world coming in. And of course, we know when the world comes in, things become complex, isn't it? But, you know, if only there weren't other people, we'd probably be all enlightened by now. So is that kind of, you know, the yellowing is the change of allowing the world coming in. And there's yellowing is in itself is a very complex color, because it has both the kind of the warmth of the sun, you know, the kind of positivity, but also it's a bit of like, you know, as you see like the paintings by Van Gogh, there's like a madness coming through yellow as well. It's like too much yellow when it kind of goes a bit like, whoa. So it's to be careful with, I suppose. So for the young prince, Siddhartha, so the yellowing, I interpret it, or, you know, I kind of see it as, you know, him sitting under the tree and basically saying, right, I'm not going to move until I gain enlightenment. and he kind of... The complexity of this phase is really represented in the different things he goes through. So it's said that he got attacked by Mara. So Mara is a bit like it's this mad energy, isn't it? Kind of coming into his experience. And it's the, you know, Mara's armies, his daughters, and then himself. And it's all of these energies, this kind of quite raw energies, kind of needing all to be kind of going through the heat of the fire and coming, you know, becoming more... becoming transformed. And I always think this when, you know, when Mara kind of, so we first have his army shooting arrows and they become flowers, and then, you know, the women, the daughters coming, and it's like he's not moving, and then finally Mara shows up himself and he actually exposes the doubts, you know, thinking, who do you think you are? And again, is that kind of madness kind of coming out. And then the Buddha's response is really remarkable. And I think I think it's one of the main reasons I'm a Buddhist, is his response to all this kind of upheaval is touching the earth. So he touches, it says he touches all the parts of his body, and then he touches the earth. And through doing that, what he's actually doing is he's recognizing that his body, himself, he is part of this world. He is not different. So for those of you who've been introduced to the six element practice, I always think of like, this is what we're trying to do in the six element practice, is trying to see that we are not different from, you know, the substance we live of, this world we live of, basically. So when Siddhartha touches the earth, is the world responds. So I think, again, that's something really inspiring. We all go through these phases of like, you know, well, me this morning, who am I sitting here giving this talk? But is that kind of, you touch the earth and the world responds. It's like it's your birthright, you know, it's birthright of being part of this world. And the world responds through the earth goddess. You know, the earth goddess rises up and she recognizes him. And, you know, it's like she kind of affirms his right to sit there on the Vajrasana throne. And then after that, it's kind of a whole lot of other things happen in the story. It's like he kind of, you know, with his divine eye, he starts to see all his previous lives and all of that kind of stuff. But in a way, isn't that all of that is not really important. I think the important bit is where he touches the earth and he for himself affirms that he belongs there, he belongs on this earth. And if you think back on the beginning of the story, so there's the young prince confused, leaving in the middle of the night. And I was thinking, you know, the moon is also this symbol of longing, isn't it? And it's like he longs for the world. He longs to be part of this world. That's why he leaves the palace, because otherwise he wouldn't have gone out in the world if he hadn't had that longing. And then he belongs. He is part of the world, you know, through this part of, you know, this kind of recognition, this realization. So he kind of opens himself up. He awakes. His heart awakes, I suppose. I find that also a really beautiful image of the bodhicitta, which I think is later than becoming the moon, is the kind of the awakening of the heart. So. Yeah. So then the final stage in alchemy is called the reddening. So it's the goal, it's the gold, it's the holy grail, or it's, you know, it's what we would think it's enlightenment, isn't it? So it's the final stage is why we set off on this journey, why we kind of started, you know, why did the Buddha leave the palace to gain enlightenment, you know, to kind of have that experience, I suppose. And again, in different different stories in alchemy, or, you know, different myths, this goal is going to become something else. It's like the philosopher's stone, or, you know, the elixir of life, or, you know, the holy grail, all of these things. But it's always something really precious. And of course, in alchemy, it's gold, you know, gold as being the most precious metal. So it's something, you know, something that comes at a great price, something we need to work for. And it's this promise, you know, it's a promise of something. And again, in the Buddhist myth, we have this promise of enlightenment. So don't think, well, I don't know about any of you, of course, I don't know, someone might be enlightened here, but it's a bit of like, actually, none of us really knows what it is, you know, we don't know what enlightenment is, but we have this promise, and if we didn't have this promise, we wouldn't be embarking on the path. So it's kind of worthwhile to have the fantasy of something called enlightenment to do a whole lot of things. So we kind of start this, and the young prince, of course, he saw this sage, and that's why he, you know, that was a bit like his promise, a promise of wisdom, of something different. I think of enlightenment as a fantasy. It's a really good fantasy because it makes us doing really good things, but I think it's really important to reflect on the fact that it is a fantasy. Anyway, you can discuss in your groups later on whether you like the word fantasy and whether you're like me sitting here telling you enlightenment is a fantasy. So it makes you think about something. It's a promise of something better. And, you know, it's like if we wouldn't, in our human psychology, if there wouldn't be that promise, we'd just be sitting in front of the telly probably. But I think also, there's not just like a fantasy, which, you know, at the end of it, there's actually, as we kind of move towards it, we kind of start to experience more and more. Our hearts start to open, basically. And I hope you agree. The more you practice, the kind of less important the goal becomes. And I don't mean it that you don't care about it. You probably care more about it, but it's something of like, it's not that kind of fantasy, it's not that end goal. You start appreciating the steps along the way. And I think that is the important part of the whole journey, is that kind of I think in Triratna we have this great tradition of friendship. This is that kind of the friendships on the way, the kind of, you know, the falling out and coming back together with friends, and, you know, all that kind of the work we do, you know, like the rough metals, you know, is the work we do along the way, the dead end streets in our meditation when we realize we just got caught up in something completely ridiculous for years, probably at times. So it's all of that when we kind of realize it's like, actually, this is what really changes us. It's not that fantasy of enlightenment. It's not that a change comes bang, you know, that night, that full moon night, you know. That was not the point where the change happened for the Buddha. The change happened all along the way. And it's so in alchemy, it's really important that the metals go through those stages. You know, they have to have the blackening and you know, the whitening, the yellowing, before it becomes, and especially the yellowing, before it becomes the gold. So it's that kind of appreciation of where we are and, you know, what we're doing with during, you know, what the work we're doing. And then I think the most remarkable thing with the Buddha is, so he has this realization, he kind of has this experience of feeling belonging to the world. And then he steps out into the world. He decides to share it. And if he hadn't done that, none of us would be sitting here. So I think it's something that makes me really... I feel I have a really strong response to of the Buddha kind of deciding to take whatever his experience was out into the world. And it's like one of the images I think about is a pearl. So it's like a pearl is kind of made or created deep under the sea, and the oyster is closed, and then it comes out. The pearl is this beautiful shining thing, but a pearl doesn't remain shining unless it's worn. So it kind of needs to be worn and taken out into the world to keep on shining. So is that sun, you know, is that kind of, it gets polished by human skin. So is that kind of sense of our practice is only going to be, you know, shining forth actually if it gets polished by other human beings, by the world. And then it kind of shines forth its beauty in the world. So in the world. So I think this, for me, this is, so we have this young prince setting off on his journey. And then, you know, it kind of is very a personal journey at first, and then it kind of becomes something that he actually realizes that, you know, other people might benefit from this, and he starts sharing his experience. And I think, yeah, just thinking about it and just sitting here, you know, 2,500 years later, and we're kind of reflecting on this whole story, we're allowing our hearts to be touched by, you know, the Buddha's experience and what he, I suppose his the beauty of his teaching, and I just find it really remarkable, basically. So I'm going to leave it there. I just want to finish with a poem, which is, it doesn't mention the Buddha at all, but I really like it because it brings out kind of the aspects of the alchemical process, and it kind of ends with the sense of like you are part of this world, which for me is very much the inspiration of practicing, I suppose. So it's called Earth by Derek Walcott. Let the day grow on you upward, through your feet, the vegetal knuckles, to your knees of stone, until by evening you are a black tree. Feel with evening the swift thickening your hair, the new moon rising out of your forehead, and the moonlit veins of silver running from your armpits like rivulets under white leaves. Sleep as ants cross over your eyelids. You have never possessed anything as deeply as this. This is all you have owned from the first outcry through forever. You can never be dispossessed.